This is Audible.
Highball Rush, Bootleg Springs Book 6, written by Claire Kingsley with Lucy Score, narrated by Natalie Duke and Stephen Dexter.
Chapter 1. Gibson. The air in Sheriff Tucker's office was too close, hot and stuffy. Resisting the urge to tug at my shirt collar, I sat staring at the table in front of me, waiting. Jamie, my family's scary-as-hell lawyer, stood behind me, dressed in head-to-toe black with a pair of heels that looked like they could puncture a guy's nuts. She was a force in the small office. Not much intimidated me, but Jamie came close. I wouldn't have wanted to be on the business end of those heels. At least she was on my side. Sort of. I could see her out of the corner of my eye, and by the glare she was giving me, she was none too pleased with this turn of events. Less than 24 hours ago, we'd all been celebrating Bowie and Cassidy's wedding. People dancing, eating, drinking, having a good time. Then Misty Lynn had lost her shit in front of everyone. I'd publicly rejected her, not for the first time, and she'd gone and stolen my damn wallet, then turned it in when she found what was inside.
"One more time. You got something you need to tell me before Sheriff Tucker comes back?"
Jamie asked, her voice quiet but sharp. "No."
"Gibson?"
The door opened, and the sheriff came in. His snow-white mustache twitched on his upper lip. I didn't look up. Didn't trust myself to meet his eyes. I was too fucking angry. And I knew this wasn't his fault. The problem was, I never should have kept the pictures. That was on me. Sheriff Tucker, I couldn't think of him as Harlan right now, not under these circumstances, took his seat across from me. I flicked my eyes up for half a second. He looked uncomfortable, maybe even apologetic. "Gibson, I take it you know why I asked you to come in here?" "Yeah." He took out my wallet and pushed it toward me. "Do you recognize this?" "It's my wallet. Misty Lynn stole it, and I assume she's the one who gave it to you." He nodded. "She found something inside that had her rightfully concerned." It was my turn to nod. He pulled out the strip of photos, four of them. We jumped in a photo booth and made silly faces. In the last one, we were laughing. They were 13 years old now and faded with age, bent from being kept in my wallet all that time. "Can you tell me who's in these photos?" My eyes skimmed over them. Although I'd carried them around with me for years, I hadn't looked at them in a long time. Hurt too much. "They're me with Callie Kendall." "When were these taken?" "The day before she disappeared." Sheriff Tucker took a deep breath, his eyes on the photos. I could practically feel Jamie holding herself back from telling me, for the millionth time, that I didn't have to answer his questions. She made a throaty noise that sounded an awful lot like a growl. "And what was the nature of your relationship with Callie Kendall?" There it was, the real question, or one of them anyway. "We were friends." "Just friends?" he asked. "You look awfully cozy in these pictures." I shook my head. Of course he'd think the worst. Everyone would. I was 20 to her 16. We were definitely just friends. "But Gibson..." I slammed my hand on the table. "I never touched her. Not once. This town might think I'm a piece of shit, but I would never have crossed that line with her. We were friends. That was all." Sheriff Tucker crossed his arms. Gibbs, I've known you your whole life. I know you ain't a piece of shit, but you seem to have been carrying around photos of you and Callie all these years, and damn it all, if no one in Bootleg knew the two of you were even together. So I need to know how it is you were friends with her without the whole town knowing, and why you never said a word about it even after she disappeared. I took a deep breath. She liked music. What's that? He asked. Callie liked music. So did I. Sometimes we'd go off and meet in the woods. I'd bring my guitar and she'd sing along while I played. We liked all the same bands, the same songs. She had a little notebook where she'd write song lyrics and I'd help her put melodies to them. That was all? Yeah, that was all. And she didn't look at me like everyone else did, the son of the town drunk, a piece of crap going nowhere. So, you're saying your relationship with her was entirely innocent? Yes. Then why hide it? He asked. Why didn't anyone know? I met his eyes. I'm Gibson Bodine, Sheriff. How do you think her daddy would have felt about his 16-year-old daughter spending time with the worst of those Bodine boys? Do you think he'd have believed us if we said we weren't doing anything wrong? Do you think anyone would have believed that? He cleared his throat. Tell me about the photos. There was a band we both liked playing out in Perrinville. It was a big outdoor thing, festival style. We met in secret, and I took her out there to see him play. Afterward, we saw a photo booth, so we jumped in and took these. And that was the day before she disappeared? He asked. Yeah. Gibson, you need to level with me here. He said, did you have anything to do with her disappearance? I met his eyes again. No. Where were you when she disappeared?
I was at home. I didn't even see her that day. I had to work. She was with all the high school kids down at the lake. Plus, she was worried about getting caught after leaving with me the day before, so I kept my distance.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around no one knowing, Sheriff said, more to himself than me. I shrugged. The town doesn't know everything. Hell, an entire person disappeared and no one knew what happened. Or at least no one who knew anything spoke up. My damn father. I didn't know what to think about Jenny Leland's story, that my dad had helped Callie get out of town. The asshole had taken that secret to his grave. He'd let me believe all those years that she was dead. Of course, I'd kept a secret about her, too. Jenny swore she was alive. She had postcards with her handwriting. I remembered it from her song journals. She'd even said she'd met Callie in person a year ago in Seattle. She swore up and down that Callie was alive. I believed her. Maybe it was just because I wanted to believe her so badly, but I did. Do you have any idea what might have happened to her? He asked. Why she was hurt? Why she was trying to get away from home? Clenching my teeth, my nostrils flaring, I fought back the surge of anger. Someone, signs seemed to be pointing to her father, had hurt her badly. Enough that she'd begged my dad for help on the side of the road, and he'd apparently helped sneak her out of town. There was no kind of bootleg justice good enough for a man who'd hurt his own daughter. Made me furious. I cleared my throat. No, she never said anything about her parents or what things were like at home. I wish she would have. I would have dealt with that asshole. Why didn't you tell anyone, Gibbs? You had to have known this could come out someday. It's suspicious. Because I knew people would assume the worst, that I was preying on a teenage girl, that we had an inappropriate relationship. My voice rose with every word. What did Gibson Bodine do now? Did he get her pregnant? Is he keeping her in a cabin in the woods somewhere? Did he kill her and dump her body in the lake? Gibson, enough, Jamie said. I didn't do anything wrong, unless playing music with a girl is a crime. Have you had any contact with her since she disappeared? He asked. No, not a word. I thought she was dead. All this time, I didn't think there was any hope. The sheriff sat back in his seat and pitched his fingers together. All right, Gibbs, you're free to go. Without a word, I scooped up my wallet and the strip of photos. Jamie's heels were already clicking their way out the door. I paused in the doorway and glanced over my shoulder. Sheriff? Yeah. Is this investigation aiming to find her or to bring down whoever hurt her? His gaze went steely and his voice was hard. Both. I nodded once. Good. Let me remind you that this is a matter for law enforcement, he said, shuffling some papers on his desk. You need to let us handle it. I know. I did know, but I wasn't making any promises. Chapter 2. Gibson. It took all of an hour before someone, Scarlett probably, started banging on my door. I turned off my phone as soon as I'd left the sheriff's office. Come straight home and contemplated barricading my driveway to keep people away. This was the part I'd been dreading since I'd realized Misty Lynn had taken my wallet. Everyone coming at me with their nosy-ass questions. I took a deep breath and got up from the couch. If I didn't let her in, she'd probably break a window. I figured it was better to avoid the broken glass.
Gibbs, I know you're in there.
Scarlett's voice carried through the door, and she banged a few more times.
Don't even think about trying to ignore me. Get your ass out here and...
I pulled the door open, and she stopped mid-sentence. Devlin was right behind her. Stepping aside, I motioned for them to come in. My house, a sturdy log cabin, sat on 3 acres of sweet isolation. It wasn't fancy, but I'd built it myself. It had 2 bedrooms, although one was just storage, a single bathroom, a living room with a wood stove, and a kitchen with cabinets I'd made custom. I'd made some of the furniture, too. The table and chairs were mine, as was the cabinet under the flat-screen TV on the wall. I wasn't much for decor, but I did have a Jameson Bodine original above the fireplace, a metal sculpture of a mountain and trees. Scarlett had added a framed photo of the 5 of us Bodines taken at Clay Larkin's wedding to the mantle. I'd gone ahead and left it there. Scarlett stood next to the couch, arms crossed, all 5 foot nothing of her ready to fuck me up. Her red plaid sleeveless shirt was knotted at the waist, and she wore a pair of old cutoffs. Devlin lowered himself into a chair and crossed an ankle over his knee. His wrinkle-free shirt and slacks were casual for him. He shrugged at me as if to say, "You're on your own."
Well?
She asked, tapping her foot.
Sheriff Tucker takes you in for questioning, and then you turn off your damn phone? Cassidy won't tell me shit, so you better spill it. What the hell happened?
There wasn't anything for it but to tell her. I had a photo of me and Callie Kendall in my wallet. Her eyebrows knit together.
What in the hell are you even talking about?
I hated talking about this. It fucking hurt, and things that hurt pissed me off. Look, we were friends, and before you lecture me about how she was a teenager and I was 20, I know it wasn't like that. She stared at me, wide-eyed.
You were friends with Callie?
That's what I just said, ain't it? We both liked music, so we hung out sometimes. Kept it secret for obvious reasons.
I have at least 800 questions right now, but let's start with the picture in your wallet.
I was stupid enough to sneak her out of town to go to a concert. We got our picture taken in a photo booth. I rubbed the back of my neck. She disappeared the next day.
Well, that's incredibly inconvenient,
Devlin muttered. Scarlett was uncharacteristically quiet. She stared at me, her mouth half open.
I don't know if anyone has ever rendered me speechless before, but you just did. How did we not know you two were friends?
I said we hid it.
I know, but nobody hides stuff in this town, not for 13 years.
My back stiffened. Dad did. She started to reply, but stopped. Normally, she defended Dad, but what could she say? He knew, Scar. Not only did he know, he helped her run away, and he never fucking told anyone.
He had to have been protecting her,
she said. I threw my hands up in the air. Here it comes.
Why else would he keep silent? If her daddy was abusing her, and it sure sounds like he was, she was probably afraid. I bet she begged him to keep quiet, made him promise or something.
You really think he kept his mouth shut for her? He did it to protect himself, Scar. He helped a 16-year-old girl run away from home, and her dad's a judge. Can you imagine the trouble he would have been in? Don't kid yourself. He wasn't protecting her.
Why can't you admit that maybe Dad actually did a good thing?
Jenny said Dad found Callie hurt on the side of the road. He didn't have to help her. He could have taken her home or just called the police and let the sheriff deal with it. But he didn't.
I balled my hands into fists, my temper on the verge of snapping. Devlin watched us argue, eyeing me like he was ready to step in if he thought I was going to cross a line with Scarlett. Stop trying to make him into the hero, I said.
Oh, come on, Gibbs. What would you have done?
I don't know, I barked. I would have kept her secret if it meant keeping her safe, but I was too mad to admit that to my sister. She let out a breath.
This is all so crazy. Callie's alive and Dad knew, and now you were her secret friend?
What else are we going to find out? That she's been living out in some shack in the woods all these years and you sent Henrietta Van Sickle out to her place with supplies once in a while?
I shook my head, some of my anger dissipating. I don't know where she is. I always thought she was dead.
Oh, Gibbs.
Before I could stop her, she'd wrapped her arms around me in a hug. I didn't like hugs, but once in a while, I had to tolerate one from my sister.
You know what's going to happen now, though, don't you?
She asked, stepping away.
The whole town's going to know about you and Callie in a hot minute.
No shit, I grumbled.
I assume Jamie's already told you what you can and can't say?
Devlin said. Yeah. I plopped down on the couch and leaned my head back. Basically, no comment. The muffled sound of a car pulling up outside carried through the walls. I groaned. Great, who else was here? A few seconds later, someone knocked.
Gibbs?
Jameson. Scarlett answered. Jameson barreled in, followed closely by his fiancée, Leah May. Jameson looked a lot like me, with dark hair and rough stubble. He wore a faded t-shirt with a couple of burn holes on the front. Leah May was tall, with blonde hair and a few freckles. She had on cowboy boots with her sundress.
Gibson was secretly friends with Callie Kendall, and he had a photo of the two of them together in his wallet.
Scarlett said before either of them had a chance to say a word or ask a question.
But he didn't have anything to do with her disappearance and didn't know she was alive. He also doesn't know where she is now.
Jameson blinked a few times, like he was absorbing that information.
Well, holy shit.
Can we talk about something else? I asked. Or nothing, and y'all get your asses out of my house?
Who else knows? Jameson asked, ignoring me.
Only us at the moment, Scarlett said. But that won't last.
I'll just stay here till it blows over, I said. I told the sheriff everything I know. People are gonna say what they say. I don't give a shit what this town thinks.
Speaking of talking about something else,
Leah May said. She had her phone in her hand.
There's something you might want to know.
What? I grumbled. I was pretty sure I didn't.
This is amazing.
She paused, excitement in her eyes.
I've never seen anything like it.
What are you going on about?
Scarlett asked.
I saw it the other day, but with the wedding and everything, I didn't want to make a fuss. And I can't even believe it. The views must have doubled in just the last 24 hours.
Views of what?
Scarlett asked.
Did someone record Gibson giving Misty Lynn the verbal smackdown?
Leah May shook her head.
No, this is so much better. Someone filmed Gibson singing at the Lookout last week and put it on YouTube. It has over 2 million views.
What in the hell are you talking about? I stood and swiped the phone from her hand, only to have Scarlett immediately snatch it from mine.
Hey! Let me see.
Scarlett tapped the screen and turned up the volume. It was me. I looked over her shoulder and rubbed the back of my neck. The video was dark, but you could see me well enough. I sat on a stool, strumming my guitar, playing one of my songs, one I'd written myself.
Oh my God,
Scarlett squealed.
This is incredible.
It really has 2 million views?
Jameson asked, pushing me aside to look over Scarlett's shoulder. I don't see why this is a big deal. I went back to the couch and sat down.
Gibbs, this thing went viral,
Leah May said.
Look at all the comments asking who you are. People love it. They love you.
I just grunted.
You never know what could happen with something like this,
Leah May said.
You don't have a manager, do you? You really should consider representation. If you need an entertainment lawyer, let me know.
Why the hell would I need an entertainment lawyer? Between Devlin and Jamie, I'm up to my nuts in lawyers already. Devlin rolled his eyes at me. Leah May tilted her head like she was explaining something obvious to a child.
All I'm saying is this could lead to something. There are lots of people whose careers began with a YouTube video.
I have a career.
Stop being so grumpy, Gibbs,
Scarlett said, handing the phone back to Leah May.
You know, some people would do anything for a big break like this.
I grunted again.
He's hopeless,
Scarlett said. I liked to play, but I'd never pursued music as a career. Never would. It was what my dad had wanted for himself, what he'd blamed me for never having. An unplanned teenage pregnancy had robbed him and my mom of their dreams. That baby had been me, and my dad had never let me forget it. Besides, some video on the internet didn't mean shit. I had to tolerate 4 extra people in my space for another 20 minutes, which irritated the shit out of me, especially after everything that had happened in the last 24 hours. I'd already had to attend my brother's wedding, although I was actually happy about that, and it hadn't been a bad time, until fucking Misty Lynn had broken a window out of my truck and stolen my wallet, and some psycho had kidnapped Jonah's girlfriend Shelby right in front of Sheriff Tucker's house. We'd found her, and she was all right, but then I had to deal with that business with the sheriff. I was done with people in general, just wanted my house to myself. After snapping at everyone a few times too many for their liking, and Scarlett calling me grumpy again, they left. With my uninvited guests cleared out, I went to my back porch, took a seat in my homemade deck chair, and I only had one to discourage company, and breathed in the silence. Birds chirped in the distance, and the August heat felt good. Movement caught my eye near the edge of the woods. Might have been an animal, but I didn't see anything. I narrowed my eyes, watching with mild curiosity. Henrietta Van Sickle poked her head out from around a tree. I lifted my hand in a wave. She crossed my land sometimes when she was heading into town for supplies. Once in a while, I gave her a ride. Even less frequently, she wandered down here and joined me on the back porch for a spell. I liked Henrietta, in large part because she didn't speak. Afternoon, I said as she approached. Her appearance put people off, and I wondered if she knew that and did it on purpose. Her clothes were ragged, but she was always clean. Straggly hair hung from beneath her old cockspurs cap, and her shoes were looking worn. I made a mental note to pick her up some new ones and leave them where she'd find them. She came onto the porch and sat cross-legged next to me. I didn't get up and offer her my seat. Knew she wouldn't take it. She never did. We sat in silence for a good long while. Although I'd wanted to be alone, Henrietta sitting here on my porch didn't grate on my nerves. We both just stared into the distance, enjoying the quiet. Surprised to see you, I said finally. After all the excitement, I figured you'd stick close to home for a while. Henrietta had probably saved Shelby's life. The kidnapper had stuck her in the trunk of his car and drove her out to an old shack in the woods. Luckily, Henrietta had either seen or heard something and followed them. She'd called me, an actual phone call, and rasped out a few words. It was the only time I'd ever heard her speak. It had been enough for me to understand her meaning and where to look for Shelby. After we'd found Shelby and turned her over to the paramedics, I'd gone out and looked for Henrietta. She'd been watching not far from the road, keeping low behind some trees so she wouldn't be seen. I'd made sure she was all right and offered to help her get home. She hadn't taken me up on it, but that wasn't unusual. Hungry? I always offered her something to eat, but not because I thought she needed it. Her brand of subsistence living seemed to suit her, and she was good at it. She shook her head, but kept looking at me, her brown eyes clear. "Need help with something?" She nodded and dug in her pants pocket, then pulled out her cell phone and handed it to me. I'd gotten her a phone several years ago, mostly for emergencies. For a hermit who lived alone in the woods, she understood technology well. She used a computer at the library, and I hadn't needed to show her how to use the phone. She didn't text me very often, usually just wandered onto my land, but occasionally she'd text asking for a ride. The screen had a big crack right down the center. "Ah, that ain't good. I'll get you another one." She gave me a closed-mouth smile, deepening the wrinkles around her eyes. Holding up a finger, she dug in her pocket again, pulled out some wadded-up cash. "Nah," I said, waving her off. "It's on me. Consider it your saving Shelby's life present." Smiling again, she pocketed the money. I didn't know where she'd gotten it, but she obviously had a supply of cash. I figured she'd brought it with her when she'd moved out to her little cabin some 20-odd years ago. I handed her phone back. "Keep this for now, and I'll have a new one for you soon." She took it, but kept looking at me, her eyebrows lifted. "Wondering about Shelby?" I asked. Another nod. "She's fine. Jonah's taking good care of her. Cops have the guy who did it." That seemed to satisfy her. She put the cracked phone in her pocket, brushed her hands together, and stood, using the porch railing to help herself up. "That was a real good thing you did," I said. She gave me a solemn nod, then walked back toward the woods. She limped a little, had, ever since I'd known her, some old injury. Like most things about Henrietta, I'd probably never know the story behind it, and that was fine by me. She was who she was, and the rest didn't really matter. I envied Henrietta's life a little bit. She lived outside the rules, made her own way in the world. People told stories about her, but the town gossip didn't seem to touch her. Gossip. I let out a long breath. There was going to be plenty of that, all with my name attached. That video was one thing. 2 million views. How the hell did something like that happen? But I had a feeling even a video of me going around the internet wasn't going to hold a candle to the story of Gibson Bodine sneaking around with Callie Kendall 13 years ago. I'd lied before when I said I didn't care what this town thought. I'd deny it till the day I died, but a part of me did care. I knew what they thought of me. Good-for-nothing son of a drunk, going nowhere fast. Some of that reputation I'd earned. I was a grumpy bastard and an asshole to most people. I started bar fights to blow off steam, always spoke my mind whether or not it was what people wanted to hear, and didn't have any patience for dumbasses. But the rest of it was down to my father, a man who'd publicly deteriorated in a town where everyone knew everything. Saw everything, judged everything. I didn't know if I'd ever get out from under the shadow of Jonah Bodine Sr.
Chapter 3. Maya. My body had no idea what time it was. The clock told me 9:13 a.m., but I was still in a haze of jet lag. I took a sip of my triple-shot latte while the elevator rose. I was used to jumping around time zones, but I'd touched down in L.A. less than 24 hours ago. If Oliver, my boss, wanted a fully awake and alert Maya, he should have given me another day to acclimate. I stepped off the elevator and flashed my ID badge at the receptionist. She gave me a polite nod. I'd never met her. It had been over a year since I'd been to Adelon Records headquarters.
It looked the same as I remembered, sleek, modern furnishings, framed awards and album covers on the walls. Yui stepped out of her office, dressed in a black blouse, white skirt, and a pair of killer red stilettos. Her jet black hair framed her face in a sleek bob, and her lipstick matched her shoes. I glanced down at my clothes, plain white t-shirt, old jeans and sandals, and decided I was too jet-lagged to care.
"Look who's awake," Yui said. "I didn't think I'd see your face until tomorrow."
I shrugged, cradling my coffee against my chest like it was a lifeline. Oliver said he wanted to see me, so here I am.
"He probably doesn't realize you basically just landed. You know how he is."
She tilted her head, looking past me.
"His door's still shut. I think he's on a call. You might as well come sit."
"Thanks." I went into her office and plunked my tired self down in a cream faux leather armchair. Yui Ito had been with Adelon Records for almost as long as I had. She'd started out as an intern and was now one of the independent record label's top publicists. She was also the closest thing I had to a longtime friend. We saw each other about once a year, maybe less. Sometimes I crashed at her place when I was in L.A. Yui was gorgeous, no-nonsense, good at her job, had a secret love of root beer ice cream, and never dated anyone for longer than 6 months. And that was the extent of my knowledge of her. It was hard to stay in touch when I traveled so much, and while most people used social media to keep up with their friends and colleagues, I had zero social media presence. I didn't even have my picture on Adelon's website, just my name and a vague description of my job.
"Your hair is cute," she said, lowering herself into her industrial office chair.
Her desk was glass and metal, her entire office impossibly cool.
"I didn't notice it last night."
"Thanks. Mermaid hair." I ran a hand down my thick, wavy hair. I'd let it grow the whole time I'd been on the road, so it was long and multicolored. I was a serial hair colorer. Over the years, I'd dyed it almost every color imaginable. Platinum blonde, red, brown, purple, blue, silver. I'd even had a regrettable black hair phase. Right now, my base color was my natural blonde, but I had a partial rainbow of turquoise, blue, lavender, and purple mixed in.
"It works on you," she said. "How long do you think you'll be in town?"
"I'm not sure, but judging by Oliver's early summons, probably not long. I'll be out of your way in a few days at most, I'm sure." She shrugged.
"It's fine. You're easy company. I barely know you're there."
"Thanks. After all the hotels I've been in, it's nice to sleep someplace where I'm not worried about what that stain on the wall might be." She winced. "Gross. How was the tour?" I'd spent the better part of the last year on an international tour with Outbound Platinum. I loved those guys, but coaxing a rock band through their first completely sober tour had been exhausting. I'd been with them since they'd almost imploded while recording their last album. Oliver had sent me in to keep them from going nuclear. My job title was producer, but around here I was known as the Rockstar Whisperer. I'd calmed the members of Outbound, soothed their frayed nerves, and helped them redirect all that angsty energy into their music. The results had been fantastic. Their album was still topping the charts well over a year after they'd released the first single. I didn't always tour with artists. Usually, I just went into the studio, helped with songwriting, or got them back on track with the recording process, but Outbound had still been too fragile, and Adelon had a lot riding on their tour, so I'd gone along like a glorified rock star babysitter.
Long, busy, exhausting, but also awesome. Pretty much everything you'd expect when you're trying to keep five newly sober rock stars from killing each other.
I don't know how you do it. She tipped her fingers together.
You must have the patience of a saint.
Not really. I don't even have kids, but I definitely had to break out my mom voice regularly. But they're such good guys. They're trying really hard to keep it together. I probably could have come back a month ago, but by that point I figured I might as well finish the tour. Plus, the last stop was Australia, and I've only been there once before. I really wanted to go back.
Please tell me you banged some hot Australian guys while you were down there, she said. The accents alone, my God. I laughed. My attempts at relationships never lasted. I didn't stay anywhere long enough to make it work with anyone. A quick fling was nice sometimes, but those were starting to feel pretty hollow. Not this time, but I totally agree about the accents. Hot. My phone rang, and I set my coffee on Yui's desk so I could dig it out of my oversized purple handbag. Half my life was in this bag. I shuffled through makeup, a hairbrush, my planner, a few cords, several power adapters, headphones, two bras, a tank top I thought I'd lost, and an unopened toothbrush before I came up with my phone. Yui stood. I'll let you take that. I need to go talk to Tracy over in marketing. I nodded and tapped the button to answer. Hello?
Maya, it's Cole. Thank God you answered. I'm seriously screwed right now.
I leaned back in the chair. I'd worked with Cole Bryson a few years ago when he'd been suffering from a serious case of sophomore slump anxiety. His first album had been a huge hit, but he'd caved under the pressure to follow it up. When Oliver had sent me out to work with him, he'd been swimming in liquor and self-doubt. I'd helped him pull himself together, write the rest of his songs, and finish the album, and it had sold better than his first.
Hi, Cole. Good to hear from you. I'm doing just fine. Glad you asked.
He groaned.
Ugh, I'm sorry. I'm just panicking.
Panicking over what?
We're in the studio, and I swear to God, nothing sounds right. I don't know if I can do this again.
Of course you can do it again. You've done it twice. Your fans love your music.
I know, but...
Cole, listen. We've been down this road. There is no but. Albums can flop. We both know that. It's the risk you take when you put yourself out there. But you can't worry about that when you're in the studio. All you need to do right now is put your heart into your music.
Yeah.
What did we talk about before I left?
Turn off distractions, get enough sleep.
Have you been doing that?
Yes, he said. I leave my phone off the whole time I'm in the studio. I've been sleeping normal hours, not going out partying, and no girls, I swear.
I rolled my eyes. Like most young men who found fame, Cole had succumbed to the allure of the countless women who were more than happy to jump into bed with him. To say they'd been a distraction was an understatement.
Okay, so what's the problem?
I don't know.
You're just playing head games with yourself, I said. Are you still recording in Seattle?
Yeah.
Here's what you're going to do. Take a day off. Drive. Anywhere, really. Just get out of the city. I've been there and it's gorgeous. Go to Mount Rainier or take a ferry to Whidbey Island. Find a place where you're surrounded by the natural world. A beautiful setting where you can just be. Let that recharge your batteries.
Okay, he said, and I could practically hear him nodding. Yeah, that does sound good.
Awesome. Then get back in the studio and get the fuck back to work. He laughed.
Yeah, I know. Thanks, Maya.
Anytime. I hung up and dropped my phone back in my bag.
Maya?
Oliver poked his head in Yui's office.
Good to see you.
Hey. I stood, shouldering my big handbag, and shook his hand. Ready for me?
Yeah, thanks for waiting.
No problem. I grabbed my coffee and followed him into his office. Unlike Yui's, which was stylishly modern, Oliver's office looked like it belonged to a hardcore music fan. He had vintage band posters and frames, and several shelves displayed his collection of music memorabilia. He sat behind his mahogany desk, dressed in a Nirvana t-shirt. His dirty blonde hair was short, his face smooth. His gunmetal wedding ring stood out against his tanned skin. I took a seat on the other side of his desk and sucked down more of my coffee.
You kind of look like shit, he said.
I shot him a glare. I've been in the country for less than 24 hours, I think. I'm actually not sure what time it is, or what day. Who are you again? He grinned.
God, I know. I'm sorry.
It's fine. Just tell me why I'm here and not sleeping off jet lag in Yui's stupidly comfortable guest bed.
Before I tell you, let me just say, I fully intended to give you some time off. I'm not such a dick that I don't realize you've been on tour and you just got back. So I wouldn't have asked you to come in if it wasn't important.
It's not that big a deal, I said. I'm used to it. Besides, you know me. I don't do time off.
Maybe you should.
I took another sip. Oliver, you're a great boss, but if I need someone to bug me about working too much, I'll call my parents.
How long has it been since you've been home to see them, by the way?
Oh my God, you just told me you were going to give me time off, which means now you're not. But you're going to give me crap about how much I work and toss in a guilt trip about my parents?
I'm sorry, I'm probably projecting. Nat's been on my case about the holidays and how long it's been since we've seen my family. It's fucking August, and she's trying to make Thanksgiving plans.
Nat was Oliver's adorable wife. While he was managing a recording empire, she was wrangling their two little boys. It's fine, and tell her I said hi. But can we get to the part where you tell me where I'm going and whose ass I need to kick? Is it Soraya again? Is she having another existential crisis? Not that I mind. I love Nashville.
No, she's fine, as far as I'm aware. I actually need you to go check out some new talent for me.
That was odd. I wasn't a talent scout. I worked with Adelon's existing artists. I didn't look at potentials.
Why? Why do I want you to check him out, or why am I sending you?
Both.
Because he has something, he said. You know what I'm talking about, that X factor we're always looking for. This guy has it oozing from his pores. I want to get to him before someone else does.
And why me?
Because we can't get him to talk to us.
I laughed. If he won't talk to you, why bother? Did you run out of wannabe rock stars who'd sell their souls for a record contract?
I'm telling you, he's different. I have a feeling about him.
Oliver did have amazing instincts. If he thought this guy was special, he was probably right.
Okay, so he's good, but he won't talk to you. I still don't know why you want me to go see him. He's a bit hostile, he said, leaning back in his chair. You have the magic touch with guys like this.
You want to send me to meet with a hostile singer who doesn't want a record deal? I asked, my tone wry.
How could I ever say no to that? I've sent you into worse situations than this. Hell, when you went into the studio with Outbound, I wondered if you'd get out alive.
I waved a hand. They're a bunch of teddy bears.
You're literally the only person in the world who'd say that. You handle broody rock stars like a champion bull rider. You're a miracle worker, and I need a miracle with this guy.
He was kind of talking me into it. Not that I knew what I was doing when it came to signing new talent, but if he just needed me to get the guy to meet with us, I could handle that.
Where is he?
Some small town in... He paused, his eyes going to his monitor. He clicked the mouse a few times.
West Virginia.
My back stiffened, and I kept my eyes down, smoothing my expression to keep the storm of emotions off my face. I picked up my coffee and took a sip, as if nothing was wrong, as if I didn't have a sudden surge of anxiety that made my stomach churn. Oliver didn't seem to notice, because of course he didn't. I was a very good actress when it came to the everything is fine charade.
You know, I don't think I'm the right person to send out there, I said, still playing the part
and playing it well. I was fine.
I don't know anything about contracts or making deals. If you need someone to get an artist past a block or prevent a band from breaking up, I'm your girl. But this, not my area. Plus, I just got back. You admitted I need some time off. Go with that instinct.
I was lying through my teeth. I didn't want time off. I never did. Oliver wasn't the reason I went straight from one project to another, never slowing down. I visited my family in upstate New York once in a while, but other than that, I was always on the road, always ready for the next project. Unless it was in West Virginia.
Fine. I give. I'll send someone else, or maybe I'll go myself, but do one thing for me.
Sure.
He clicked his mouse a few times. Listen to him. Someone took the video in a bar with their phone so the sound quality could be better, but tell me what you think. Maybe I'm wrong about him. I'd like your opinion. The screen faced away so I couldn't see, which I appreciated. Oliver was always interested in talent first and foremost, rather than looks or image. We both knew that image mattered, but a pretty face had always been a distant second when it came to recruiting new artists. A hum of noise, like a crowd in a bar, almost drowned out the sound of an acoustic guitar strumming the first chords of a song. Someone whistled, and another person hooted. The melody grew as the crowd quieted. Whoever he was good. The song was soft, almost mournful. Before the guy even started singing, it was tugging at my heartstrings. Then he sang the first line, and my breath caught in my throat. That voice, it was deep and husky, with a sexy, gravelly quality. I knew immediately why Oliver wanted to sign him so badly. He did indeed have that special something. But that wasn't why I suddenly felt like I couldn't breathe. Nor was it why I found my lips parting and words leaving my mouth. Okay, I'll go. I'll talk to him.
Chapter 4. Gibson. The Crafty Cow Tavern in Hayridge, about 50 miles outside Bootleg Springs, was crowded. Couples swayed to our songs in front of the tiny platform they called a stage. Tables were full, bar stools all occupied. Not bad for a Thursday night. Tips ought to be good. I sat on a tall stool, one foot on a rung, my guitar in my hands. It wasn't the tips that brought me to places like this. Sure, pocket money was nice, but mostly I just liked to play. A guitar and a song. It was what I loved. The size of the crowd didn't matter much. 2 people or 200 didn't make a difference to me, although even I could admit there was something satisfying about an audience. But it wasn't about my ego. Music was a transaction. To really be what it was meant to be, music needed a musician to create it and an audience to listen. It was the kind of give and take I could appreciate, and this audience was loving on us tonight. Corbin was to my left on keyboard and hung behind our drummer. We were simple and country and didn't look like we made a lick of sense as a band. Hung was old enough for his hair to have gone gray. Corbin was barely old enough to be in the bar. And at 33, I was somewhere in the middle. But we played damn good music. And that was what the crowd was here for tonight. We played, they listened. Simple. I liked simple. My fingers strummed the melody and I sang the last few lines. Applause rose in a crescendo as my voice trailed off. I gave a nod and put my guitar back on its stand. We'll be back after a short break. The crowd clapped and cheered again. Seemed as if a bunch of people were holding up cell phones. Had they been recording me? Jesus. That stupid viral video bullshit needed to die a quick death. It had been over a week since I'd heard about it, and Leah May said it had started before that. Some jackass claiming to be from a record company kept calling me, and now this? Weren't people over it by now? I went to the end of the bar and leaned my forearms on the smooth wood. The bartender handed me a water, and I took a long drink. Felt good on my throat after singing for the better part of an hour. A guy backed into me, spilling water down my shirt. Damn it, watch where you're going, asshole. He whipped around, crowding my space.
What did you call me?
The guy reeked of cheap beer and cigarette smoke. I waved my hand in front of my face. A shower ain't a bad notion, buddy.
The fuck you talking about? You want to start something, pretty boy?
Pretty boy? That was a new one. I'd been called plenty of names in my life, particularly in bars like this, but never pretty boy. I couldn't help but laugh.
What you laughing at?
He poked me in the chest.
Instantly, I stopped laughing, my blood running hot, my mood flipping to anger like a light switch. My brothers weren't here to back me up, but I didn't care. He'd touched me. The need to hit someone or something made my hands twitch. I wanted to feel this fucker's nose crunch under my fist, craved it like a drunk craved whiskey. "Touch me again and I'll break your face," I growled.
"Is that a threat, pretty boy? You think you're famous now? You can just roll on into our town and be a dick to everybody?"
"Go ahead," I said, my voice low. "Touch me again, please."
"Slow down there, Gibbs."
Hung's arm shot out in front of my chest.
"Not tonight. We have a set to finish."
I held the dickhead's gaze, my eyes cold, face expressionless. "Do it, asshole. Hit me." I loved it when the other guy took the first swing. He looked me up and down and took a step back.
"Whatever."
I didn't take my eyes off him until he disappeared into the crowd.
"Why you gotta do that, Gibbs? We're here to play, not brawl with the locals."
I held out my wet shirt. "I didn't start shit. He spilled water on me." Hung raised an eyebrow.
"It'll dry. Let's go."
I finished my water and joined Hung and Corbin back on stage. Took my seat on the stool, slung my guitar strap over my shoulder, and adjusted the microphone. Without any preamble, we started in on our next song, "Take Me Home, Country Roads." It was always a crowd pleaser. In seconds, the dance floor was packed. I didn't bother looking for the jackass who'd almost picked a fight with the wrong guy. He wasn't important. Instead, I lost myself in the song, in the feel of my fingers strumming the strings, the harmony of our instruments, the rhythm, the way it felt to belt out the lyrics, the energy of the crowd. The audience didn't just take. On a good night, they gave back just as much as they got. Our music made their bodies move, touched their hearts, and in turn, they filled the air with electricity, with a powerful energy. Big crowd or small, the energy was there. It fed my soul in a way not much else did. We rolled right into another song, keeping the energy alive. It seeped into my skin, ran through my veins. This was my high, right here on a little stage in a rinky-dink bar in some podunk town. I loved this shit. I didn't admit that very often, but I did. The crowd danced, cheered, and sang along. With that song done, we paused just long enough to murmur to each other about what to play next.
"Play the one from the video,"
someone called. I glanced up. Who'd said that? I'd only played that song the one time at the lookout, and only because I'd lost a bet with Jameson. I'd never planned on playing it again in public. Playing covers of songs everyone loved was easy. They knew them, knew the words, enjoyed them along with us. But my song, one I'd written? More people chimed in, calling for me to play the song. I looked over at Corbin, but he just shrugged. Hung nodded. I grunted and let out a breath. Fine. The crowd hushed as soon as my fingers hit the strings. And there it was again. Their energy. It pinged off my skin like shocks of static electricity. I sang the first few lines and the power grew. It surrounded me like heat from a fire on a cold night. The lyrics poured out, my voice deep and low. I lost myself in the melody as if nothing else in the room existed but me, my guitar, and that supernatural energy the crowd gave back to me. Applause erupted as I strummed the last chord. I opened my eyes, hadn't quite realized I'd closed them, and stood,
gave the crowd a nod like I always did. My heart beat a little too fast, and I wanted to get out of the spotlight. Singing that song again left me with a full feeling in my chest. I needed some water. I started to lift the guitar strap from my shoulder when my eyes landed on a woman in the crowd. Her hair caught my attention. It was long and blonde, but in the dim light, I could make out streaks of color, maybe purple and blue. It was hard to tell. She had tattoos on both arms, dark t-shirt, jeans. She was busy with something on her phone. I was about to look away when she glanced up, meeting my eyes. A striking sense of familiarity swept through me, like I should know her from somewhere. She had a scar on her cheek running down through her upper lip. That wasn't the sort of thing you'd forget, but I'd never met a woman with a scar like that, so why did it feel like I'd seen her before? Once in a while, I locked eyes with a girl in the crowd. Sometimes that ended with us in a hotel or back at my place, but this felt different. She was beautiful, no doubt about that, but that wasn't why I couldn't take my eyes off her. She broke eye contact first, her gaze going back to her phone. I let out the breath I hadn't realized I'd been holding. That was weird. A second later, I looked up again, and she was gone. I had an inexplicable urge to find her, but my guitar strap suddenly felt like a spider web sticking to every bit of skin it touched. I tore myself free, set my guitar down, and pushed my way into the crowd. I didn't see her in the throng of people, not near the bar or between me and the restrooms. Could she have made it to the ladies' room that fast? I didn't think so. Another glance told me she probably hadn't. There was a line, and she wasn't in it. Someone bumped into me, but I ignored them. What the hell was I doing? This was ridiculous and stupid. Why was I following some girl? I didn't chase women, literally or figuratively. But it was like I couldn't help myself. She must have gone outside. With my heart pumping strangely fast, my veins filling with adrenaline, I pushed open the door and went out into the warm night. The light next to the door cast a dingy glow over the quiet parking lot. The bar was right off the highway, but the road was empty this time of night. Nothing out here but the sound of frogs and crickets. I spotted her off to the side, walking toward a car. I knew this was crazy. I knew I had to be wrong. But before I could stop myself, I said it out loud. Kelly?
Chapter 5. Maya. My breath hitched and I stopped in my tracks, my car keys dangling from my hand. Tension rippled down my back. I glanced over my shoulder, keeping my voice smooth and even. Sorry, my name's Maya Davis. Maya? He said. Walk away, Maya. Just put one foot in front of the other. He didn't say more, but even without looking, I could tell he hadn't moved. I walked to my car, but paused again, next to the driver's side door. I liked your song. Thanks, but... I didn't wait to see if he was going to keep talking. Hardly aware of what I was doing, I unlocked my car, got in, and drove away without looking back. I'm Maya. My name is Maya Davis. I gripped the steering wheel, chanting it in my head over and over. I'm Maya. My name is Maya Davis. My crappy motel wasn't far from the bar. I parked and got out, feeling dazed, like I'd just hit my head. My hand shook, making my motel key rattle against the big plastic keychain. I couldn't get it in the lock. Was this the right room? I glanced up at the number on the door, 105. This was mine, I just couldn't seem to make my hands work properly. I never should have come here. The door opened, finally, and I shut and locked it behind me.
touched the lock a few times to make sure it was secure. My heart raced and my limbs tingled with adrenaline. I leaned back against the door and took a deep breath. I needed to calm down. The room was a riot of maroon and blue with carpet that made me dizzy if I looked at it too long. The light over the sink flickered, but everything smelled faintly of lemon and bleach, so at least it seemed clean. The motel's version of a minibar was a basket of packaged snacks and some tiny bottles of Jack Daniels. I grabbed a water glass from the counter next to the sink, unscrewed the cap, and dumped in the whiskey. It burned going down my throat, making me wince. I wasn't much of a whiskey drinker, but I took a second sip anyway. Sip? Gulp? Semantics. He'd called me Callie. No one had called me by that name in 13 years. I wasn't Callie Kendall anymore. I'd left her behind a long time ago. But this was Gibson Bodine. Why had I thought he wouldn't know me? The box in my mind, filled with old secrets, shook. It had been the key to my survival when I was a kid. I'd put away all the bad experiences I had at home and left them there. It was what had allowed Callie to put on a smile in public, go to school, hang out with her friends, act like a normal girl. And the lock I'd put on it was indestructible. It had to be. Callie's life depended on it. After I left Bootleg Springs, everything that had been Callie had gone into the box. Not just my home life, all of it. Who I'd been, the people I'd known, the places I'd loved, my old friends, Gibson, and Bootleg Springs. My favorite place in the world. It hadn't just been a summer home to me, it had been home. But I'd had to put it all away, lock it up tight. Seeing Gibson's video when I was thousands of miles away in L.A. had made the box rattle, just enough that I was reminded of its existence. But moments later, it had stilled. The lock had held. I was safe from its contents. But being near him, breathing the same air, hearing his gravelly voice, had broken the lock and popped the lid open a crack, enough that the contents whispered their dark secrets. Memories beat at my subconscious, trying to break free. They still threatened to come out. All those demons I'd worked so hard to hold back. Closing my eyes, I visualized the box. It sat in an otherwise empty room. Its form had always been the same, an old-fashioned cedar chest with an enormous metal lock hanging from the latch. The lock was on the floor, open. The lid was ajar, as if something unseen was in the way, preventing it from falling closed. In my mind, I crouched low and picked up the lock, pressed the lid down to close it, and locked it up tight. Letting out a slow breath, I opened my eyes. Better. Except Gibson Bodine wasn't in the box anymore. He'd been one of the hardest casualties to bear when I'd left. Fear had kept me from contacting him. I'd fled for good reason, and my fears for my safety had been very real. They still were. The fewer people who knew where I'd gone, that I was even alive, the better. But God, it had hurt. I lowered myself onto the edge of the bed, old memories flitting through my mind. Afternoons spent by a little fire deep in the woods so no one would find us. Gibson sitting on a log, strumming his guitar. Those icy blue eyes. Stubble on his square jaw. Me singing along, finding harmony to his melody. I'd lived for those afternoons, just the two of us, isolated from the world. We'd talked about our favorite bands,
about album covers and song lyrics. He'd taught me to play guitar, and I'd filled journals with half-written songs. When I'd left, I'd had to let that all go. Gibson and all of Bootleg Springs. I'd put it in the box and locked it. I wouldn't have survived if I hadn't. But now that he was out, I didn't think I could put him back in. Another deep breath and another sip of whiskey. I'd lied to him tonight. Lied right to his face. But he'd known me, said my old name. That had been such a shock. I looked different than I had 13 years ago. The altercation that had prompted me to run away had left me with a broken nose and a scar on my cheek. I'd had surgery to repair my nose, but it was more sloped now. And I hadn't received medical attention right away, so there hadn't been much they could do about my cheek. Between that, my dyed hair, and aging from 16 to 29, I'd thought I looked different enough that I wouldn't be recognized so easily. Apparently, I was wrong. That meant I needed to leave, get myself out of West Virginia as quickly as I could. Even after all these years, I wasn't safe here, not as Callie Kendall. The postcards I'd sent to Jonah Bodine had been the one thing I'd allowed myself.